Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country. With 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and conversations with a couple veterans I met at the Dallas Retirement Village in Dallas, Oregon, just outside of Salem, where you can hear Hometown Heroes every Saturday morning and every Sunday evening on affiliate KYKN, 1430 on the AM dial in Oregon's capital city. We heard from Donald Newsom, survivor of the USS Franklin. Now we're going to hear from Earl Proctor, who grew up in Galena, Kansas, the son of a World War I veteran. And you talk about a family of service. Earl is one of 5 brothers. One younger brother served in the Korean War, another in Vietnam, and the other 2, like Earl, were in World War II. One in the China-Burma-India Theater, the other in the Marine Corps, wounded on Okinawa. Earl's job in Europe was to treat the wounded as he advanced with the 253rd Infantry Regiment, the outfit that saw the most intense action as the 63rd Infantry Division blazed a path of blood and fire through Germany in the spring of 1945.
We stationed there at Sargemein, and Sargemein was just across the river, and we were supposed to hold the lines because that was right after the Belgian Bulge, and we were supposed to hold the line there until we got ready to final jump off into Germany. And while we was there, well, we was making raids into across the river and up in the area. Our medical team, the 4 of us, was told to go and pick up a fella that was over the hill 4 miles out of the town. We went up this hill, and we was falling in kind of a little dead fur. I could see tracers going between me and the squad leader. And I said, let's hit the ground. We hit the ground. We laid there and listened to the bullets going right over our back for quite a while. Then we went over the top of the hill and down to, we could see the guy down there laying in the middle of the field, and he raised his arm up. And the medic that had been with the outfit had bandaged him all up and left him there. So we went down, put him on a stretcher, grabbed him up, and started running up the hill. We heard a shell coming, and looked back, and the shell went off right where we'd just been with him. And we picked him up again, run again. Another shell came off right just where we just was left there. We made it over the top of the hill and back. We carried him back into town. It's 4 miles back into town. So they gave us all the bronze medal for going out and hitting him and bringing him in. Anyway, when we jumped off for the final drive, we was going so fast that we went across the Rhine at Worms and then turned and went toward the south. And we was west, I think, of Nuremberg when we had B Company had went over one little knoll, and they was going up the second one. They got hit pretty heavy, and they called the aid station. We need medics, need them bad. And so the lieutenant looked around, and he got the first sergeant, the Jeep driver, and 4 of us medics that just came in. And the 7 of us got on that Jeep and went around, and he said, well, this land hasn't been cleared as far as he knows, but he said, we'll try it. So we went around this whole knoll, and there's trees across the road. We just jump out and grab the Jeep, go out in the ditch, across the ditch, out in the field, and back on the road again. We went around the first hill, figured to get in between the two and go up and rescue those guys. Anyway, when we went around the hill, we drove into a farmyard. There was Germans everywhere, and they was all carrying burp guns, so Jeep driver stopped and started back up, and they just brrr, right underneath of us.
I think a lot of people who listen to this show have heard about a burp gun before, but you're talking about a very high-powered automatic weapon that can put out so many rounds that they basically just saw you in half, right?
And they didn't hit us because we all had medical armbands on, or everything on the Jeep was marked with Red Cross, but they captured us. And then they took us from there right back over behind that place into a little village, took us in, questioned us each one at a time. And they kept the lieutenant and one private, and we never did see them. Then they put us with an old Army veteran and with a rifle, and he started us walking. And we walked every day. And we was trying to join the big group of prisoners. They dumped out the Americans and the British out of the prison camps up north, and they was heading them toward Munich. We walked every day, and some days we'd spend the night in a barn. One night we spent a night in an old dungeon in a castle. Almost froze to death that night. One time we stayed in an old camp that had been vacated. All that was in there was just Russians. The Americans and the British had all been evacuated and headed south. So we finally joined that 2,000 crew. And just a couple of days after that, the war was over. So they said that 63rd planned on going to the South Pacific to finish the war over there. So they gave me my choice of going back to the outfit or going with the prisoner of war. So I chose the prisoner of war, and they took us up, all of us. And some of those guys had been in there a year and a half, 2 years, was just skin and bones. And we took them up there to northern Germany and went through processing. They fumigated them, gave them haircuts, and killed off some of the lice in their head, hair lice. Anyway, there they sent us on up to Le Havre. We was up there, and they fed those guys up, to feeding them eggnog and everything, trying to get them physically fit to ship home. And I worked on the ship coming home. I worked as a medic, and we had a crew working round the clock with rotating, taking care of those guys. And when we got into close to New York, everybody was up on deck to see the Statue of Liberty that was physically able. I don't think there's a dry eye on that deck. Anyway, we came back, and then I didn't have that much time over there, so they gave us a furlough, and then they sent us down to Hot Springs, Arkansas for R&R, and then from there they sent me on to Seattle, and I was up there working in the medics, running the dispensaries, and we was processing the troops going to the South Pacific and the ones coming home from South Pacific.
You shared a lot of information there, and I know we're short on time, but I want to flesh some more of that out. When you're a medic in that situation, and you described it for us, I want people to understand. I mean, there's some people in the medical corps that are at an aid station that might get shelled or something, but they're not out there in combat with the infantry, and you were, right? You're following the squad leader.
Yeah, I was. Sometimes when we went out with the company out, well, we would tag along behind as a medic for him to take care of the wounded. That's what happened to the one we picked up. The medic had doctored him up. He had 14 shrapnel wounds. They bandaged him up and left him there because they couldn't carry him. And so it was our job to pick him up, get him back. And we kept track of him, and he pulled through all right. So.
And you got a Bronze Star for rescuing him. What do you think would have happened to him if you guys weren't there?
I don't know how long he'd have to sit there, but I know that friends of ours in the Belgian Bulge, when they got overrun, that one of them that I knew from Seattle that I got acquainted with down in Yuma, and he'd been injured, and he played dead, and they went right by him and went on by. But he said they had a radio that could call out, but there was no way in the world any troops could get to him because so many Germans had already went by him. So he was down there for 24 hours, and his feet froze. Now he's had special shoes.
Well, and that happened to a lot of guys in and around the Bulge. You mentioned also bringing that Jeep around and running right smack dab in all these Germans and getting captured. But you were telling the story so fast, it sounded like it wasn't that big of a deal. I mean, this is a big deal. This is your life. This is your freedom. What went through your mind when you saw how badly you were outnumbered and realized you're going to become a prisoner?
We really didn't know what to expect. And it was pretty scary because we didn't know what was going to happen. We still, after we went up there and got questioned, we still didn't know what he's going to do with us. But the five of us, they took out and separated us. When they took us in there and questioned us, they asked us all these questions, what our artillery outfit was with us. And I said, I can't answer that. And they said, well, what anti-tank outfit was with you? And I said, I can't answer that. And he said, you can or you won't. And I said, I can't answer that. And he said, oh, here, take your stuff and get out of here. And those guys spoke good English. And I gathered up all my stuff there and put it back in my aid pack and walked out.
I've had several guys on this program who were part of the march that you're talking about, who were prisoners in those camps and were marched across Europe. So you're saying you guys had your own mini march and then joined that longer march with thousands of POWs. But those guys, the conditions they've described were pretty brutal. I mean, they had been starved for a long time. Maybe you'd been better fed recently, but still. No, you weren't. Okay, tell me the story.
Well, we ate onion stew pretty regular. Their food supply was limited. So what we got was very skimpy. If we got a small loaf of bread and a can of beef for the group, that was a good meal for us. That would hold us.
And you guys would march all day, right?
Yeah, we walked every day.
Where would you sleep?
We slept in different places. Like I said, one night was the dungeon, one night was in barns, one night was in an old camp that had been vacated of all the Americans. They kept a guard on us all the time. So,
did you see people who couldn't keep marching, who had to fall out?
Yes, and in that 3,000 group, there was a lot of those guys who fell out, and they had a wagon going along that would pick up the ones that couldn't walk anymore. Most of the fellows managed to walk. So many of them had diarrhea and stuff, so and they had their pants right lapped clear over in front of them and stuff with belts clear around the back. Some of them that weighed probably 200 and some pounds, probably down 100 and something. So,
how hard was that to witness?
It was tough. It was tough to see it. But then we took them up there to Camp Lucky Strike, where I was at with the group. And they had three camps up there of all the VWs. They had eggnog in those 30-gallon drum garbage cans. Those guys go through and get a big canteen cup full of eggnog. They was feeling the eggnog and all that stuff, trying to get them physically fit to bring home. I kind of wonder sometimes how many of those guys lasted very long with the health that broke like it was.
Well, I've met a few of them, and they were pretty resilient, the ones that I had a chance to meet that survived this long. For you, though, were you, I imagine it gives you some hope if you come across a POW camp where the Americans and British are gone because they wanted to get away from the Russians. Does that tell you that you're not going to end up a prisoner forever, that there is light at the end of the tunnel?
We kept walking, thinking maybe we thought our outfit would finally liberate us. And we could hear them in the distance every night. But the next day we'd walk, get out of the range of the artillery. But then usually by the next night we'd hear artillery fire off in the distance. But they finally caught up with us. They pulled into the camp there where we sat with our own outfit. So they gave me a choice to come back to the outfit or go with them. So.
And that's pretty unique. Of all the prisoners of war that I've talked to, I don't know if I've ever met a guy who was liberated by his own division. So it was the 63rd that liberated you. And where was that?
They said we was 50 miles north of Munich. That's where they're supposed to be heading.
How did it come about? How did you realize that you're a free man again?
We didn't know it until one of the fellows got up that morning to go out to the latrine, and he yelled back and he said, "There's no guard on the door here at the barn." We was in a great big barn. We all got up and realized then that the Germans took off already. And that's just shortly that morning, Jeep pulled in the yard there, and our captain from our outfit told us that they was retreating. The Germans had been retreating out of there, so it was just a matter of time until the war was over.
That had to be a pretty good feeling.
Yeah, it was.
You mentioned sailing into New York and seeing that statue, and you said there wasn't a dry eye. I guess that includes your two eyes. What was going through your mind in that moment as you looked at that statue?
Well, I didn't think we'd ever make it. When I went over, I seen so many people that got killed that I didn't think that we'd ever live through it. But when you hit the ground, two of you, and the guy next to you, when you get up to go, and you reach over and say, "Let's go," and he just, he's dead. He got hit with a piece of shrapnel. You got missed. You make you wonder. You know that somebody was praying for you. So I think that I was well blessed to go through it without getting injured. Because anytime you see tracers come between you and the squad leader and not get hit with one of them.
And how much space was between you and the squad leader?
Well, probably 20 feet.
Close enough, yeah.
We hit the ground. We just laid there and listened to the bullets going right across our backs. So, and that's when I realized that even the buttons on your shirt felt like they's too thick. You try to hug that ground as close as you can get because, you know, the bullets are pretty close.
Well, I'm sure we only scratched the surface of your story, but I want to say thank you for serving our country and thank you for telling us that. Is there anything else you think is important for us to know now, 70 years later?
No, I just wonder, you hear so much pro and con on this, how much we should get involved with other countries. But, you know, we stayed out of that war for so long that Germany had a pretty good start before we got in it. I think personally, if we hadn't got in it when we did, it wouldn't have came out like it did. Germany had all that land taken already, and they were there, and they had those big guns there at Le Havre that was shooting those big shells across into to England. They were sending those buzz bombs over there into England and stuff. And when we landed there, we had troops land there in Normandy. We lost a lot of guys there on that battle. But I think if we hadn't got in it right then when we did, we wouldn't have had the effect that we had.
That's a very good point historically, and a word of caution as we look toward the future. I wish we had more time. Two remarkable men with pretty captivating stories we've had the privilege of meeting today. For photos of Earl and Don and other related information, visit hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you can join us again next time for a conversation with the candy bomber of the Berlin Airlift, and reminding you once more that freedom is not free.